You're listening to the Let's Be Real podcast. Now, here's your host, Andy Hughes.
Our guest right now has one of the most recognizable voices in sports. After earning a PhD in radio, television, and film from Bowling Green State University in 1976, he's accomplished so much in the broadcasting world. He has covered over 40 years of professional hockey and has called over 3,000 games. He's won over 5 Emmy Awards and was the first broadcaster ever to be inducted into the United States Hockey Hall of Fame. He also received the Foster Hewitt Memorial Award from the Hockey Hall of Fame for his excellent contributions as a hockey broadcaster in 2008. You can now hear him on NBC as the lead play-by-play voice for NHL hockey. Let's welcome Mike Doc Emmerich to the Let's Be Real podcast. Doc, thank you so much for joining us. How are you?
Andy, I'm wonderful, and it's great talking to you, and also I admire the tack that you have taken with this podcast and the dedication that you have brought about to it and the direction that it has taken. So I am anxious to be able to contribute in any way if I possibly can.
Well, we really appreciate you coming on. And before we get into some of the topics, I wanted to ask you, how is your wife doing and how are the dogs?
Oh, they're all wonderful. Everything is terrific. They don't have their antlers on for Christmas yet, but I imagine that'll be one of the things they'll be thinking of. Everything is festive and all wonderful. Thank you.
That's awesome. And, you know, I just kind of want to start with your career chronologically here. When you were growing up as a child, did you always want to be a broadcaster? Was that always something that you wanted to pursue when you were growing up?
Well, almost always, initially, until I realized that I was never going to grow very tall because it was in Indiana. And, of course, your value in Indiana as an athlete tends to be with that sport where you throw a ball through a hoop and get 2 points. Or back then it was only two. I mean, the three-point line hadn't been developed yet. And so my athletic ability was determined at a very young age to not be that great. So I was an addict to AM radio in the 1950s growing up, and of course most of the baseball teams in the Midwest, Chicago, Cincinnati, Detroit, Cleveland, were all on AM radio stations, and many of those were strong enough that even in rural Indiana during the day, and then distant stations like Pittsburgh and Philadelphia and St. Louis would come in at night. And so I could go up and down the dial and live the life of a baseball fan and play baseball with my brother in rural Indiana and dream of getting in free to be a baseball announcer. And so the first time that I was probably had an aspiration to be a baseball announcer, I was 8 or 9 years old. And that didn't change until almost the anniversary of the day that you and I are talking, in December of 1960, almost 50 years ago, when I saw my first hockey game, a minor league game in Fort Wayne, Indiana. And it was like an epiphany, and all of a sudden baseball was out and hockey was in. That was what I wanted to do.
Very interesting. Yeah, and I knew you were a big baseball fan. That's interesting, though, that you just saw a hockey game and you were drawn in. And I feel like hockey has that effect on a lot of people. You know, when they go to their first game, they say, wow, this is unbelievable. And I feel like that was kind of the same thing for you, wasn't it?
Yeah, it doesn't win you over most times, and that sounds like a heretic from a TV announcer. Television doesn't win you over to the sport. Radio certainly doesn't win you over to the sport, although the voice of the person who is describing a game on radio can do that. But it can get you to go see a game, perhaps. But what wins you over in what does hook you was what hooked me that night, and that is being there and seeing all of the action and the color and excitement of being inside an arena and the atmosphere of it all. And that's what did it for me. And I think that's one of the value that developmental teams have. They may not be in the biggest cities, but they do provide the exposure of the sport. And so whether it's a college team or a minor league team or a junior team, whatever it happens to be, it does give people a chance to see the game live, and I think that's what wins them over.
I couldn't agree more. Now, another interesting thing about you is that you taught speech and broadcasting at Geneva College in Pennsylvania for a few years, and you also were an unpaid correspondent at the Beaver County Times newspaper. What were some of the lessons that you learned, and what were those experiences like?
Well, I guess I should say that the motivation for becoming a speech teacher at Geneva was I needed work, and graduating with a master's from Miami University in Ohio, I had sent my tapes, which were made in the corner of the Coliseum in Fort Wayne broadcasting, to myself, an audience of one, these hockey games. Mm-hmm. And so I'd sent these tapes that I'd made all around to minor league teams in every league in 1969. And remarkably, I heard back from most of them, but they very politely declined my services. I had no experience, and it probably sounded that way on the tapes. So I needed a job. And there was this school in Western Pennsylvania that needed somebody to teach speech, public speaking, and broadcasting, and supervise the operation of the campus 15-watt FM radio station that was operated pretty much, and the talent for all of the programs was by students. And so it was something that I was familiar with, having gone to a small church-related school myself as an undergrad in central Indiana. And it was near Pittsburgh, and I was a Pirate fan. And it also was near Pittsburgh, and it seemed to present me an avenue to see the NHL on a regular basis. And so I was young and single and anxious to have a job that would pay me instead of me going into debt like I had for 5 years attending school. So I took that job. And after 1 year of teaching at Geneva, I went to the editor of the Beaver County Times, which was our daily evening newspaper in the Beaver Falls area, where Geneva was located, and told him I would cover the Penguins for nothing if he got me a pass. And he said, it sounds like a good deal to me. So I got a pass and was a member of the Professional Hockey Writers Association for a year. Of course, I paid for my gas and parking across from Civic Arena to cover the 70-71 Penguins. And I finished my second year at Geneva teaching there while I was also doing this sort of sideline job, and then realized that, you know, hockey might not open up an avenue for me at all. And to earn a living as a college teacher, I'd better go and get the advanced degree, which was a PhD. And there were two schools that located in the Midwest near where my family was, Bowling Green and the University of Michigan, that had doctoral programs in broadcasting and film. But also had campus stations that carried the hockey games of the university team. And as fate or providence or whatever would have it, the campus station at Bowling Green had a staff member that did the first and third periods of the hockey games, but a student was allowed to do the second period, and that guy had graduated. So when I visited Bowling Green to see what it was like, the man who was in charge of the radio programming was also the broadcaster of the hockey team's games and said, you come here, you can do the second period. I said, do you need an audition tape? He said, no, you're on. You can do it. So that made up my mind, and I went to Bowling Green, did the coursework, and had a legitimate audition tape that wasn't made in the corner of the arena. It is actually an over-the-air station, and sent those all around. And right after I'd finished my coursework at Bowling Green, a station in Port Huron, Michigan, in the International Hockey League, hired me to do their games for $160 a week, and I became a professional announcer, and that was 47 years ago.
Wow, that's an awesome story. Thank you for sharing that. It definitely paid off. I know being an unpaid correspondent may not have been the greatest thing, but it was a great opportunity for you, and you made the most of it, and I think that's great. That shows a lot about your attitude. Now, a lot is made about a player's journey to the NHL. You know, that's talked about a lot, how hard it is. But I would have to imagine it's kind of the same thing for a broadcaster, as you just said.
Well, it is. And I think the thing that you have to do is a lot of self-talk. And I know, you know, goaltenders and other players that I've come along with and from the minors up have told me that that has been an important part of their life too, is belief in themselves and also having people that can encourage them when they get discouraged. There were times when I was in Port Huron, Michigan, and we would be on the road in Des Moines, and it was 6-1 at the end of two for Des Moines, and we weren't coming back. And I knew that. And so the third period would be, you know, dreadful. Well, you're working by yourself. You have to make it interesting for yourself as well as the listener. And many of them have given up too. And you know that the game isn't going to get any closer. And so it really does challenge you as a broadcaster. And then you're riding the bus 14 hours to get back home. And it makes you wonder sometimes, is this really what I want to do? And the answer to that is yes. And that is not always the answer that some people get. They decide that, you know, this is not really, I'm not really that committed to this. And that doesn't make them a bad person. It just means that they find something else that really motivates them in life, and it's not broadcasting a hockey game. So good for them. But in my case, I didn't wear out. I didn't get tired of it. And I had people that encouraged me along the way. And that is an awful lot about what helps make a person resilient. And I think that's a lot of it. The great educator Suzuki said that all that becoming successful is all knowledge is skill plus doing something 10,000 times. Well, I've only done 3,600 games, so I have a long way to go, and I'll never get to that. But I really do appreciate the people who have helped me along the way. And I've tried to write a snail mail note to each of them I can think of. Because a lot of times you go through your life and you realize that you haven't acknowledged those people, except maybe once when you last saw them before you left working for them. And then decades pass. And you realize that, yes, they were very important to you, and you should remember that. I think when Fred Rogers stood up at one of those award ceremonies in New York and said, I'm going to keep the time 10 seconds for you to think about all the people that in your life that have gotten you here where you are tonight. And then there was this incredible silence, and some people giggled and some people had tears in their eyes, and you realize that everybody has people like that that get them to where they are. If they have any measure of success in life, they don't do it all by themselves.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, that's a definitely great thing to share too. Fred Rogers, especially with the movie coming out. Yeah, that's definitely an awesome moment. Now, you were talking a lot about support and people that helped you along the way. Fast forwarding a little bit, in the early 1990s, you were diagnosed with prostate cancer. Can you take us back to that moment and how you were able to overcome that? I'm sure you had a lot of support during that time.
Yeah, I sure did. And the other part of it was, too, that I was flat out lucky. I had a wonderful doctor who knew my family history, and prostate cancer does often have a family connection. And he just noticed something unusual, and there had been ultrasounds taken before, and they came up with nothing. And he said, why don't you go to a different lab this time? So I went to one that was a little further away. And so they did an ultrasound, and they found nothing. And they said, look, you came this distance. You know, it doesn't hurt. And physically, it doesn't hurt you if we take biopsies, too. So why don't we do that since you came this far? And so they did. And sure enough, the biopsies showed cancer. So that was found to be very early. And prostate cancer is unlike others in that it moves slowly. And so I was lucky. I had a good GP who was suspicious, and it was caught early. And so I was fortunate in that regard. It was treated surgically. I did not have to have chemo. I did not have to have radiation. So I was fortunate. But there were a number of people who stood with me during that time, and you never forget those people. I've often told this story, and I'll try to do it quickly. Red Kelly, that year that I was covering the Penguins in 70-71, one night I went down, and only Myron Cope and I went down. He was the famous Steelers announcer who was doing sports for Channel 4. We went down, and Red noticed we were the only two that went down after the game. The Penguins had been playing terribly, and he was drawing a comparison to life. He was not saying anything about the fact only two of us were there. But he said, you know, my father always told me you can count on one hand the number of people who are with you at the most difficult time in your life. That was not his most difficult time, but he was making a point. And you realize the people that are there for you at that time may not be large in number, but they're large in dedication.
Mm-hmm. Yep, they absolutely are. Well, I'm so glad that you know, you had that support and you were able to pull through. Now, also, when we look back at your career so far, you've done so much. Did you ever have a time when maybe you were just starting where you learned a big lesson while you were on the job? Because I think it is important when you're doing new things, you kind of have to get yourself out of your comfort zone in a way in order to develop as a person. Did you have any times where maybe something went wrong or you really had to learn something while you were on the job that, you know, you really just had to think back and say, wow, that was a big moment for me?
Well, you always realize that I've done over 3,600 games and I haven't done a perfect one yet. And there was a period of time, and I don't know, Andy, when the change took place. There was a period of time when I was so worried about trying to be totally accurate on everything that I realized I was sounding almost too surgical, too clinical, because I was just trying to be so accurate about everything. And you can sound so much like a scientist or a clinician and not like a human being. You become mechanized. And you don't laugh at yourself very much. You don't sound like a person. And at some point, and I don't know where it was, over a period of time, I finally realized that, A, I'm never going to be able to do a perfect game. B, if I concentrate on trying to do a perfect game, it's not going to sound good, and I'm going to be preoccupied all night with making that first mistake. And C, people tend to enjoy it more when you aren't perfect anyway, because you're more human, and everybody is one of those. So I don't know where it took place, but it was a learning thing that it took me a long time to get. And I'm glad I got there. And so tomorrow night, after I've spoken with you, I'll be doing St. Louis and Pittsburgh. And I don't know how long it'll take me to make my first mistake, but I will.
Now, that's an interesting way to look at it. You're right. I mean, we are all human. Everybody's going to make mistakes. There's no such thing as a perfect game. So you do an amazing job. Always love listening to you. Now, other than broadcasting, you're also heavily involved with the NHL Broadcasters Association. And you were a big part in developing the NHL pronunciation guide, which is very interesting. I have to imagine that was a time-consuming process and something that takes a little bit to maintain, given the number of players that come in and out of the game.
Yeah, that went from 1984 until the big lockout in 2004. So it was about 20 years worth. And during the absence of the entire year's lockout, the league took it upon itself. They had plenty of time to think, and there were people thinking of how they would have the players recite their name into a microphone, and then they would transcribe that. So they took it over electronically from the Broadcasters Association in 2004. But up until that time, here's how it worked. Up until that time, whenever, let's say, I was doing the Devils games and I would go into Hartford, I would look at the lineup, and then I would go to Chuck Caton, who was the broadcaster for the Whalers, and say, Chuck, how do you say this guy? And so we decided that rather than us doing that all season long whenever we went into each arena, what we would do is have the announcer for each team, when they went to training camp each fall, go to each of the guys whose names were a question, even the guys that were going to be in the minors, and who could be called up at any time, get all the names, and then phone me with them, leave them on my answering machine so I could play them over and over again, and then I would convert them phonetically. And then by opening night, I would have produced an analog typewritten guide on each of the on all of the teams in the league and all of the names that were questionable and phonetic pronunciations. And then eventually it wound up being circulated by the league, which, you know, made the Broadcasters Association even more important and significant in that we produced this for the league before, as I said, in 2004 during that winter when the league took it over. But it was an interesting time, and it made me an unofficial authority because I was sort of the clearinghouse for all of the announcers in the league calling in these pronunciations. So before they were distributed, I went over them again and again. And so just by rote, I learned the pronunciations the players wanted for their names before everyone else had them distributed.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's a very interesting process. And as you know, I used to broadcast high school hockey games. I can definitely appreciate a pronunciation guide because there are a lot of names and a lot of different ways that you can say things. So it's definitely helpful. And I'm sure a lot of people were thankful that you started that. Now, before we were getting on the show here today, I'm looking at social media and I have to ask you, you now have your own special at Primanti Brothers here. It's a pastrami sandwich and a drink, which is now called the Doc Emrick Special. How did this come about?
Well, they just chose me. I am flattered beyond belief because having a sandwich at Primanti's is enormous in the city of Pittsburgh. And yeah, it's a wonderful sandwich with cheese. And then, of course, the two slices of tomato and the slaw, and then, of course, the fries on top. It's a magnificent sandwich, stands about 5 inches high, a little bit large for even a mouth my size to try and get around it all, but it's a great challenge, and it's a tasty sandwich, and I recommend it highly. But you can't go wrong if you walk in the front door of that place.
No, you certainly can't. I agree with that. Now, Doc, last one here for you. You've accomplished so much in your career. You know, you're part of Hall of Fames. You've won so many different awards. You know, you've been able to call Olympic games. You've done so much in your career with such an impressive resume. What drives you to keep going?
Well, I just enjoy the sport, and I like the people that I'm around. I like the people I work with, and I like the players and coaches. It's a really good group of people, and that sounds trite, but the origin of this game is rural Canada, and it hasn't changed markedly despite the money. There are, out of 700 players, there are probably close to 500 millionaires out of 700 players. The first time we ever published the salaries, there were two, Wayne Gretzky and Mario Lemieux, and that was in the late 1980s. But they don't act that way, and they still come to work in a bus. And even though from the time that I came into the league in 1980 to now, we've taken in players from this year, 20 different countries, instead of just Canada and a handful from the United States like we had before. The atmosphere of the dressing room is still pretty much rural Canadian. They look you in the eye, they'll answer your question, as long as it won't hurt their team. They don't want to provide material for the other team, and they don't want to embarrass teammates or anything like that, but they're cooperative. And by and large, this is a wonderful group of people to work with. And that's why it's fun to go to work, and it's fun to keep doing it. And there will come a time, because there does in everybody's career, there will come a time when either I'm not happy with my work, or I'm just tired, or somebody is not happy with my work, but that hasn't happened. And NBC has assured me that it'll be my call. And they did that about 7 or 8 years ago, but that moment hasn't happened yet. And so until it does, I'm just going to enjoy the moments that I have. And one of them comes up tomorrow night between the Blues and the Penguins, two teams that would love to have their starrest of star players playing, but won't have because of injury. Mm-hmm. But if they get them later in the year down the home stretch, that's when they'll need them the most anyway. So maybe the time that they have, that they're resting now, will be a bonus time for them later on. And they'll have Tarasenko hopefully later, and they'll have Crosby later too.
Yep, that should be an interesting game. Well, Doc, I just, again, want to thank you again for joining us here on the Let's Be Real podcast. You're not only a Hall of Fame broadcast, but you're also a Hall of Fame human as well. So we really appreciate you coming on and taking time to talk with us. So thank you.
Thank you, Andy, and I wish you all the best in this venture that you've settled on, and especially the philosophy that you've taken with it, too. All the best to you. Thank you.
And there he goes. That was the great Doc Emmerich. And just so you are aware, that conversation was recorded in early December. You may have noticed that he mentioned the game tomorrow. And that's who Doc is. He's very prepared, always on top of things, and that's why he's one of the best in sports when it comes to broadcasting. Now, I want to mention something that Doc said. Doc is one of the best broadcasters in the world, and even he had to go through some things to get where he's at. I think a lot of people think that people that are on top of their industries just get there, and they don't have to struggle through anything. They don't have to take an unpaid opportunity to get where they're at, and that's not true. Every person has their own journey, and I would encourage you, if there's something that you would like to learn more about, maybe it's a fellowship, maybe it's a class, do it. Even if it's not a paid opportunity, you're developing yourself, you're learning more, and it's going to help you in the future. Listen to what Doc said earlier. He took an unpaid correspondent job with a newspaper just to get into the locker room, just to network with people, and it worked. He eventually made his way to be an NHL broadcaster, and now he's in the Hall of Fame. Everybody has to do it in some way, shape, or form. They have to get better every day, and Doc is still doing that today. Make the most of any opportunities that you have, and you will be successful.